Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to wonder, you know, Trump offered the gift cards for seniors, that $200, hey, $200 goes a long way. Also, the payroll tax holiday that you're probably going to have to pay back in April anyway. I got to wonder if the $200 is something that seniors are going to have to pay on too. And the reason I bring that up is we find out that, you know, Donald Trump over the last, 17 years that they got his tax return paid like $1,500. So I got to wonder if those wonderful gifts that Donald has bestowed upon us are things that we're going to have to pay back anyway to fund the fact that he hasn't paid his taxes. And here to share some thoughts on his on the bombshell New York Times story and Trump's tax returns, I've asked Matthew Gardner to come talk with us. Matthew is a senior fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Matthew, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So am I getting this right? From 2000 to 2017, we got a guy sitting in the White House that paid a whopping $1,500 in taxes. Am I getting that right?
In general, yeah. What we know from the Times is they looked at 18 years. They found a tax bill of zero in 11 of those years, $750 a year for another couple of years, and there are a few other years in which he probably paid something more. But it's a pretty steady streak of paying little or nothing in a period when he allegedly was making an awful lot of money.
Yeah. So is this the smoking gun? I know a lot of people the last couple of years, they thought, oh, my gosh, if we got the tax returns, this is going to be the smoking gun. Going to take him down. Is this going to matter?
Well, it depends. I mean, on one level, this is not news. You know, the New York Times, a lot of these same guys have reported in the past year pretty similar things.
Right.
What's interesting about it, and what I think might make this a little stickier than the prior revelations, is that there's some shady stuff going on here. There are a couple of stories that indicate that it's maybe not just as simple as him using, as he has said, the legal tax breaks that are available to everybody. And in particular, there are a couple of cases where really the most charitable thing you can say is that he is pushing the line between what's legal and what's not. And there are a couple of things in here that just make any sensible reader ask, why has the IRS not already reversed this? Why is it even under audit in the case of this one $700 million deduction he's probably claiming wrong? So there's some real indications that he's just not, things aren't as straightforward and as purely legal as he's claimed they are.
Yeah, that's what I said from the beginning. I go, look, for the most part, I'm sure it's not illegal. And he's pushed the boundaries, because there were some stories over the last couple of years that he had taken a housing tax credit that there was no way he was eligible for, because it was a low income tax credit. And the joke was, well, he's clearly not as rich as he claims he is. And I think these tax returns show some of that.
Yeah, that's right. The claim has always been, you know, wink and a nod that that Trump is a very rich and very successful guy in the real world who is able to transmogrify his income into a tax loss. But it's a fake loss done strictly for tax purposes using depreciation. You know, he's always said depreciation is his best friend. What this says to me, the revelations in this report, is that maybe he really does just lose a lot of money in the real world. Maybe he's just not that good a business person at all. And this is true in particular of the debts. You know, there are two numbers that really jumped out on the debt front from this. One is that over the past decade, he's basically walked away from something like $260 million of debts. Debts that, like, the folks he owed the money to just basically said, we're not collecting it. They wrote off the debts, which itself is an indicator of the guy stiffing everybody right and left, either because he can't pay or because he won't pay. The other thing is that right now, the Times says he's got in excess of $400 million of debts that he owes to somebody, much of which is going to come due in the next 4 years, which, you know, it's possible that he's got the liquidity to pay some of this stuff. But the pretty clear sense you get from the article is that this is a guy who's been selling off his assets. You know, the ones that didn't already get lost to bankruptcy, he has less and less. And so it's not at all obvious to me that he's got the capacity to pay these debts off. This to me seems to be like somebody who's in a pretty unstable financial situation.
Where he's going to walk out of the White House and file bankruptcy again. And right. this is one of those moments where, you know, the $400+ million that he owns, that he owes, there are a lot of people going, well, who does he owe it to? And is this one of those moments where could it be some shady people who are leveraging him for one thing or another? There's a whole bunch of this is why you vet candidates from the beginning and why we should have had this information in 2015.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the focus on the debts and whether his income is really substantial, I hate to say it because I'm a tax guy, but this suddenly becomes less of a tax story and more of an income story. What does this guy actually have? Is it all an illusion? The debt thing, I think, is important, again, for non-tax reasons, for exactly the reason you allude to. If you've ever owned substantial money to anybody, you're in debt to anybody you know that it changes the relationship you have with people. It's no longer a level relationship. You're in debt in multiple senses to these people. If any of the people to whom he owes this huge amount of money are people he deals with regularly in the foreign policy community, then it's entirely plausible that his decisions in the past 4 years, certainly his decisions if, God forbid, he wins election, have been and would be tainted by that relationship. It's I think, as Pelosi called it today, a national security risk and something that people look for when they're hiring for high security positions. Do you have large debts? So it's a real concern in ways that go way beyond sort of these basic questions of tax payments. And that actually is, I think, something that gives me a little bit of hope. If he's been bulletproof on the tax stuff forever, because a lot of the people who support him just say silently or think, well, I'd do that too if they could. I don't think anybody thinks that way about debt, about massive amounts to debt to some possibly very shady people. People understand that that doesn't make a lot of sense. It's certainly not something you aspire to, and it's not the sign of a successful businessman.
Yeah, I mean, because we were sold on the idea that, you know, he was going to run things like his business. And I kept saying all along, if you look at his businesses, they're not doing that great. And now we have tax returns to show that. And look, we've got an economy in shambles. So he has taken his business Ackerman and brought it to the public sector. And here we are, successive trillion-dollar deficits, a massive debt that they've added onto the national debt. And that's even outside of the pandemic. We were running trillion-dollar deficits without the pandemic.
That's right. And this leads into something I wanted to mention, which is that even before the pandemic, one of the most obvious solutions for this problem, giving more money to the IRS to enforce the tax laws, wasn't happening. You know, even before the pandemic, we were already paring back our spending as a nation on tax enforcement. The IRS in 2020, this was a decision made a lifetime ago in February of 2020 when the pandemic wasn't a thing. Congress appropriated an amount for the IRS budget for 2020 that was less in inflation-adjusted terms than what they'd done in 2019, which it turns out they've done now 10 years in a row. We're spending less money on the IRS in real terms than we had the prior years. That means less enforcement. It is the reason why audits of high-income individuals are nearing an all-time low. It's the reason why we're auditing low-income people more than we're auditing high-income people. ProPublica did an excellent study last year where they showed that the single county in the U.S., you probably know this already, that has the highest audit rate is Humphrey County, Mississippi, which also is one of the poorest, most rural, and yes, most African-American counties in the nation. We're targeting low-income, poor minorities who claim the EITC, not the wealthy folks like President Trump, who are clearly able to, you know, beat the tax system like a pinata because they know the enforcement isn't coming for them.
So for me, isn't this where we should be talking about? I mean, this, I know Trump being part of this, you know, dominates the story, but I've been talking about this for years, the fact that the pendulum has swung. And look, in 2010, I was with the T-Twits who were running around screaming taxed enough already. Only their solutions were just insane and lost me almost immediately. But look, we've seen a tax code that swung the massive amount of wealth to the top. We've created the world's largest billionaire class. In fact, the largest billionaire class in history at the expense of the working class. There was just a study done the other day by Nick Hanauer and my friend David Rolfe who came out and said, look, the working class is getting ripped off at a tune of about $2.5 trillion each and every year for the last 45 years. And where do you think that money goes? To people like Trump and his ilk who are cheating like hell on their taxes.
That's right. And, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that the CARES Act, which most people think of sensibly as a bill containing a lot of short-term relief for working class folks, also included, incredibly, a huge tax break, $135 billion over 10 years, exactly for people like President Trump, increasing their ability to use losses, usually made-up business losses, to offset their income tax in prior years going back. It's basically a tax cut that was tailor-made for continuing the sort of practices that the New York Times just outlined yesterday. So it's not just a past history thing. Somehow, incredibly, this huge tax cut geared by definition towards millionaires was one of the biggest tax items in the CARES Act, a thing that was ostensibly all about COVID relief. Yeah. So this is very much a work in progress.
No, and again, you look at the CARES Act, and it was a huge handout to corporate America. I was not a fan of some of the things it did, the $500 billion slush fund to hand out to corporate America. I wasn't in favor of. I said what we should have done is we should have made the workers whole, give the money to them, and it'll flow to the corporations. They'll get theirs. But no, we had to have our corporate welfare first and foremost, and this is where we are as a country. So I guess the question then becomes, are we surprised when you have a government run by, you know, the very wealthy and funded by wealthy donors, that you have a tax code that benefits them?
Sadly, it's not surprising. And I think it is important at this point to recognize that the legal tax breaks that the president has used here, depreciation, net operating losses are the big ones. These aren't like Republican, Democratic partisan divides. These are tax breaks that both parties have, when they've had a chance to pare them back, chosen not to. And in fact, in the last tax cut, they even expanded these things. So there is blame to go around. The good news is, I think we're seeing a shift toward recognizing this is unacceptable, recognizing this is a problem. And it's a shift we're seeing both in terms of public opinion, which is now radically in favor of making corporations and the rich pay their fair share, but also in terms of policy. You know, and it comes from people like Elizabeth Warren, who have proposed both a wealth tax on individuals and a strong corporate minimum tax. The latter of which is now something that candidate Biden has said he wants to do as well. So the direction of policy promises that we're seeing and the direction of public opinion, I think, is shifting enough that eventually Congress is going to have to listen. If enough people get mad about companies not paying their share, about Trump being emblematic of a whole class of the richest Americans who aren't paying their fair share, I think we're going to see policy follow public opinion a little bit.
I hope you're right. I hope you're right, because there's a lot of things we're mad about that doesn't seem to be addressed. Maybe this will be one of it. And the last line of questioning I wanted to get to, because you use the term fair share, and there are a lot of people going, well, you know, the rich pay all the taxes, Matthew. They've got all the money, so clearly the thought is they pay all the taxes. And I always throw back that, you know, during the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, the top marginal tax rate was considerably higher. In fact, more than double, at 92%. You know, where are we talking about, you know, moving this back to? AOC took a whole ton of guff over saying, you know, people making over $10 million a year should be taxed at, oh my goodness, 40%. I'm curious, is there a place where you guys are looking, going, maybe this is where we need to be? Because look, I think we're coming to the reality that we can't have a country run by oligarchs, that we can't have a country of extraordinarily wealthy people who have the kind of outweighed power and speech that our Supreme Court has given them.
Well, I think, you know, fairness is obviously in the eye of the beholder. We have right now a slightly progressive tax system overall. The only way you can describe it as this socialist nightmare is by looking just at the federal income tax, the one tax we have that is clearly progressive. But it's stacked up against a federal system which has huge amount of state and local taxes that fall disproportionately on those at the bottom of the income spectrum. So we have overall a system that is pretty darn close to flat. It's a lot less progressive than it used to be. Fairness has been a big casualty of the 2017 tax cuts, of the tax cuts pushed through by George W. Bush before that and by President Reagan before that. one first totally straightforward strategy for getting back a little closer to fairness would be to take away tax breaks for capital gains, to get us to a place where the capital income reported by the wealthiest shareholders has to be paid at the same, so you pay tax at the same rate that low-income workers pay. That's a pretty straightforward ask that almost anybody would agree with. And so I think that's a straightforward place to go. Obviously, as the New York Times report has shown, we also need to think a lot more seriously about adequately enforcing the tax laws we already have. If this is, it's so clear from this that a lot of the strategies President Trump has gone with, he's doing it because he has no expectation that the IRS is going to have the teeth to come after him. You're writing off $70,000 of hair care expenses as a business expense. We know this is not a business expense. Paying his daughter $740,000 in consulting fees to do a job that she was already responsible for as an employee, it's transparently tax avoidance and possibly even tax evasion. We don't know, but it, at best, it's suspicious, and it's indicative of a system where the laws don't mean anything. So yeah, capital gains, think about higher marginal tax rates on the best off, a millionaire's tax, if you will, but also get to a point where people like President Trump and other upper income taxpayers can't just get away with whatever they want, as they apparently are.
Yeah, no, because I was going to bring that up about Ivanka Trump and her consulting fees, because I was going to ask you, you know, is there a way that I can pay my kids to be consultants here on the show so that I can fund their college? Can I write that off?
Well, I'm working on the hair care thing myself. It's going to take me a few decades to work up $70,000, but yeah, it's trailblazing stuff would be the polite way to describe it.
There you go. Scary, scary stuff. I guess before I let you go, what do you think the message out of this should be? Because there's a lot of people saying, you know, Democrats should let this go. Is this a big deal?
It's a big deal in that it's a big deal in a non-tax sense. The tax stuff is old news. I mean, he's bragged about not paying taxes. What's new and really damaging and frankly frightening, I think, to most of us is what we don't know about how much debt the president really has and these very scary questions about who he owes money to. This could really be a national security risk of exactly the sort that that people have been warning us about. And it brings into question the honesty and the legitimacy of the foreign policy decisions he's been making, some pretty puzzling ones for the last 4 years. So that, I think, is what we need to be focusing on, not what this says about his taxes, already a pretty established thing, but the questions this asks about who this guy owes.
No, excellent point. Matthew, I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Matthew Gardner, Senior Fellow at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. You can check out their website, ITEP.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.